Eichel Menachem presents A Tale of Two Souls, an ongoing lecture series on the Tanya by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Jacobson. This is tape number 28 in the series, entitled The Journey of a Bruised Soul in Its Afterlife, recorded live at Eichel Menachem, Brooklyn, New York.
Good morning, everyone. Tanya, chapter 8. Perek Ches, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, for page 25. We are in the middle of the page, the line beginning with the words Yamav Kirabeno HaKadosh, and the dot by the word Va'al Dvarim B'Teilum. In the previous classes, we have come to learn that the purpose of the Jew is to reveal and introduce into every aspect, into every experience, into every act, the harmony, the perfection, and the absoluteness of godliness and spirituality. Every moment of the Jew's life is to be an exercise of harmony with the divine reality. How can this be achieved? When the Jew is engaged in studying Torah, when he's engaged in prayer, when he's engaged in doing a godly mitzvah, we can understand. But when the Jew is involved and connected in other areas of life, mundane physical areas that are seemingly divorced and detached from being godly, spiritual, and transcendental, how do we say that those experiences can indeed become an exercise of harmony with Hashem? So the answer, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe, has explained, because every single thing, every object, every phenomenon, every moment carries within itself a divine essence and a godly purpose. It's just that there are the forces of klipa, which means the shell, the forces of the shells, of the husks, that conceal this essence and this purpose, giving the thing, the phenomenon, or the moment an illusion of self-efficiency, of arbitrariness, suppressing all but the faintest glimmer of godliness and of a purposeness of being. The purpose of the human being is to come into the world and to penetrate that shell, to break through that veneer, to bring to light the divine essence, vitality, and purpose of every single phenomenon, of every single thing. How does a human being do this? By dedicating and utilizing that specific thing that he or she is dealing with in accordance with its true purpose. In other words, by dedicating them to the service of their Creator, through that He makes them an instrument in holiness, divesting them from their mundane shell and expressing, bringing to the fore, to the light, their divine soul and purpose. Through this, the Alter Rebbe has explained, every moment of the Jew's life and every experience that he experiences in his life becomes imbued with true meaning and wholesomeness. For every single experience has now become an expression of harmony with the truth and absoluteness of existence, which is, of course, the reality of Hashem and everything connected to Hashem. What if a person, however, doesn't live in such a manner? Rather, he deals with the world, with things, with objects, in accordance with the concealing and obscuring shell. He sees in the thing not a mirror and a reflection of a deeper purpose. He does not see the thing as something which is to be utilized for a spiritual, godly purpose. Rather, he deals with that for its own sake. So what happens at that moment is that instead of the ability that the human being had to utilize the thing in a way which is consistent with its quintessence, instead of utilizing his ability to sanctify the elements of materialism by dedicating them to the spiritual godly reality, instead he has become hostage to the klipa, to the veneer, to the shell, to the husk of life. He chooses the wrapper of the jelly bar instead of the jelly bar itself. He chooses the peel of the watermelon instead of enjoying the watermelon itself. In this instance, in this scenario, the Alter Rebbe explains man would be doing misjustice to all components involved in this act, beginning with himself. He utilizes his soul and his energy for a hollow act, for a purposeless goal devoid of truth and inner significance. So he allows his soul, his body, all the energy that was invested in this act to fall prey to the klipa reality, to the shell reality. The same can be said about other components involved in this act, including the thing itself with which he is dealing with. He did not utilize it in accordance with its true essence and purpose. Rather, he has made it fall prey to its outer shell, and furthermore, to the klipa of reality, which totally obscures and conceals the inner purpose. In the beginning of the 8th chapter, Perikas, the Alter Rebbe gave the example of food, of eating, which is one of the most common experiences of a human being every single day of the year. When a person comes in contact with food, whatever type of food it may be, over here is his choice. Either he can eat and consume the food in a purposeful manner. He eats the food with a realization why he's existing, what is the purpose of his existence. And he wants that the food should become an instrument and a medium through which he can achieve his purpose of existence. In other words, practically speaking, he eats l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven, so in order he should have energy to live a productive, good, holy and godly life. Then what the person does is, he imbues this very mundane, apparently very mundane act of eating with true purpose, with inner significance. He has now imbued the food with a transcendental reality, allowing it to mirror and reflection, to mirror and reflect something of the harmony of the perfection of its creator. He has brought its divine essence and purpose to the fore. He has sanctified all components connected with this act, beginning with himself, with the food, the act of eating, the moment in which he performed the act of eating, etc. But if he eats the food in a gluttonous manner, just to enjoy pleasure for the sake of pleasure, pleasure per se, so then he deems the act hollow. He has perpetuated now the illusion of the shell dynamic. He has robbed the food away from its true essence, from its true significance, from its inner identity and purpose, from what its function is. Rather, he has transformed the food into an instrument for klipa, for the husk of reality, rather than transforming it into an instrument for reality itself, for true reality. And the same is true about himself. The energy that he has invested in this act of eating, the same is true about his body, have now become included in the realm of the husk, in the realm of the shell. And Alter Rebbe continued and said that even afterwards, when the human being returns to serve Hashem, and then he redefines the significance of these substances, because he is utilizing their energy now for a godly act, for a purposeful act, for a transcendental act, and then he elevates them and sanctifies them, nevertheless, his body still remains tainted. because the food which has originally become an instrument of the klipa reality has become part of that body, of the flesh and the blood of reality. So the body has become tainted, and this is the reason why after the person's passing, the body has to experience something called chibut hakever, purgatory of the grave, which is a bodily experience, to purify it, to cleanse it from the spiritual stain that has defiled it and has impurified it by acts of this nature.
If it would be a forbidden substance, like forbidden food, is initially connected to a realm defined in Tanya as Shalosh Klipos HaTmeis, the three unclean klipos that totally and absolutely obscure and conceal their divine essence and function. Hence the divine spark, the divine vitality and purpose remains trapped and confined within a powerful shell and husk that doesn't allow it to come to the fore, and the Jew therefore cannot deal with it. He must negate it, he must stay away from it. But if you're dealing with something permitted, this receives its vitality and energy from a shell called Klipas Noiga, the translucent shell, the glowing shell, which although it is a husk, it is a concealer, nevertheless the human being can penetrate it, can break it, can bring the divine purpose to the fore. But even after he has done that, and he has redefined the significance of this food, nevertheless his body has become tainted. Till here, the Alter Rebbe gave the example discussing physical bodily self-indulgence. Now we will continue to describe other scenarios of self-indulgence, which are less bodily and more subtle. Because the same doctrine which applies to the Jew eating applies to every single experience of the Jew 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether it's eating, whether it's talking, whether it's thinking, whether it's walking, or engaging in any reality whatsoever. Physical, more physical, less physical, more subtle, less subtle, whatever it may be. The Jew has the unique merit and opportunity, and hence obligation, to introduce transcendence and the harmony of godliness into every act, into every phenomenon, into every single reality which he or she comes in contact with. The first example the Alter Rebbe gives is of idle talk, dvarim b'talim. And just as concerning food, he didn't discuss necessarily forbidden food. He discussed even permitted food. When the Jew eats permitted food, not for the sake of a godly purpose, he and the food have both been affected. The same is true concerning talking. He does not begin with discussing chatting forbidden words or harmful words, just idle chatter, which are hollow, which are purposeless. The very fact that the Jew has engaged in this activity and not imbued it with a divine essence, with a divine purpose, is already misusing a precious moment, a precious opportunity, a precious substance, himself, the words, and every dynamic that was involved in this act. Let's see inside. As for innocent idle chatter, it's dvarim b'talim. The human being engages in talking idle words, idle issues, but it's innocent. It's permitted. So you'll ask immediately a question, how can you say that idle chatter is permitted? In the Torah there is a continuous obligation to study Torah. On the pasuk that we say in Krishna every day, Vishinantam Levanachi, you shall teach them to your children, Vidibarta Bam, you shall talk of them. When you're sitting at home, when you're walking, when you're going in the way, when you retire, when you rise. Our chazal, our sages tell us in Masechta Yumah, Daf Yetes, Vidibarta Bam, Veloy Bidvarim Acherim. Talk of them. And do not talk about other things. There is a constant obligation to study Torah. So how can you say that talking dvarim b'talim, idle chatter, is permitted? So the Alter Rebbe explains, Kigayna ma'aret she'ena yachal ilmit, such as in the case of an ignoramus who cannot study. since he cannot study due to his ignorance, so to engage in words which are forbidden, that he's also not allowed to do. But if it's dvarim b'talem, if it's just idle chatter, it has no deeper, godly, useful purpose or significance. It's just talking for the sake of talking about whatever it may be. This is called dvarim b'talem b'hatter. If, again, if it would be dvarim asurim, forbidden words, it would be connected to which realm? To shalosh klipos hatmeis. But since it's dvarim b'talem, it's connected to klipos naiga. Klipos naiga, which is the translucent shell. But when this human being talks these words, he has invested his soul and his energy in something which is hollow, in the shell of life, in the veneer of life. It is divorced from its true significance, its true purpose, its true essence. So his soul becomes affected. Sarich l'tayir nafshe mitumazu biklipazu. He must have a soul cleansed from the impurity of this klipa, which characterizes idle chatter, al yidei gilgula b'kafakela, through the soul being rolled in an dynamic called kafakela, which means the hollow of a sling, k'may shekasuv b'zoyar, parshas b'shalach, daf nun tes, as is stated in Zoyar and parshas b'shalach, page 59. The term kafakela, literally, the hollow of a sling, first appears in Tanakh, in Shmuel Aleph, in chapter Chafhei, Perik Chafhei, Pasuk Chaftes, where the Navi tells us the story about David HaMelech's conversation with a woman named Avigail. Avigail had a husband, Naval, who has rebelled against David. Naval was extremely lowly and coarse person, and his wife Avigail, who was an extremely righteous and extraordinary woman, went to beseech and ask mercy from David that he should not eliminate her husband Naval and his whole estate. And among the things that she told David in this pasuk was, "Vayakam Adam liridavcha ulavakish es nafshach." A man has risen to pursue you and to seek your soul. But v'haisa nefesh adoini tzrura b'tzrachayim es Hashem alakacha. The soul of my master of David is bound in the bound of life, in the bound of Hashem. V'es nefesh ayvecha yikalena b'soich kafakala. But the soul of your enemies he shall sling, as out of the hollow of a sling. So the soul of my master, he shall bound, it's not about the present, it's about the future. He shall bound up with the bound of life. The soul of your enemy, he shall sling out as out of the hollow of a sling. So the Gemara, in Masechta Shabbos, Daf Kuf Nun Beis Amud Beis, interprets this pasuk. Tanya Rebbe Elazar, Emir Rebbe Elazar says, the difference between the souls of the righteous people after they depart their physical embodiment, and the souls of the wicked people. Nishmasam shel tzaddikim, Rabbi Eliezer says, are connected to the realm of the kisei hakavod, of the throne of glory. Gnuzay tachas kisei hakavod. They are concealed under the throne of glory. And he brings this pasuk, v'haisen nefesh adayin yitzruru b'tzerachayim. But v'sharishayim, what occurs to the souls of the wicked people? Zayman mais v'halchis, they are continuously imprisoned. Umalach echad oimid b'seifayilum, umalach echad oimid b'seifayilum, umekali nishmasan zelazah. And one angel stands on one side of the world, another angel stands at the other side of the world, and they throw, they sling their souls one to the other. What is the symbolism in this unusual imagery that is being used in this Gemara? So one of the explanations given in Chassidus is that the experience of kafakela, the hollow of the sling, is that the soul is taken from its present circumstance, environment, and location, and it's thrown in, or it's placed back into its life in the physical world to re-experience what it has experienced in this world, then it's placed back in its present state, and so on and so forth. What does this mean? So it may be understood through examining the process existing in our day and age, the process of psychoanalysis, taking in, of course, the consideration of the very significant differences between the two. If a human being experiences in his life a certain obstacle or a certain psychological or emotional inability, there is a deep scar in him that is the cause for this problem that he possesses. How do you get rid of the problem? You can't just strip the problem away and it's gone. Then you're dealing with the symptom. But the symptom has a cause. There is a reason why the human being has a difficult to do something, to act in a certain way, whatever it may be, whether it's difficult for him to experience healthy relationship, trust, love, intimacy, whatever it may be. What can be done to rectify it? Now, the cause for it is not recognizable anymore. It's not conspicuous. It's not evident anymore. Something might have occurred to him when he was very young. Something he might have been afflicted with by educators, by parents, by colleagues, by siblings, whatever it may be, when he was yet a little child. And this is just a symptom that comes out years later, has always been there, but now it's evident. And the person begs to be helped. But how can you help him? You can't just take away the problem, it has a cause. So one of the methods is that the person has to be brought back to that original situation. The human being, who is an adult already, has to re-experience what he has experienced at that moment when he was scarred. He has to relive that past situation and get it out of his system. Because what happened was he was scarred, and that scar was buried and suppressed, and it's there. And it sheds forth its voices. And its effects are evident in the person's life. He has to go back, re-experience that dynamic, spit it out, get rid of it, and then he comes back and he has been cleansed. And automatically the symptom is gone once the cause is gone. The more the scar is subtle, the deeper it may be embedded, and the more difficult it is to get in contact with it and to get in touch with it. But nevertheless, it's difficult and it's a very painful experience. It's a painful experience because the person has buried it deep because of deep fears. He didn't want to have it revealed. But it's part of the healing process. The healing process, he has to go back into it, expose it, and spit it out. And then automatically he becomes a new person. Something very deep was taken out. Just as this is true concerning psychological reality of a person, the same is true concerning the spiritual reality of a person. The soul, after it leaves the physical, its physical embodiment, ascends to the spiritual realm. And it enters into a godly realm of existence where there is no klipa, where there is no shell, where there is no husk. There's only godliness. But there's a block. For some reason, the soul cannot fully enjoy and experience the spiritual godly world. There's a certain block. There's something there. And for this block, the neshama has to go through certain experiences to remove it. What is the block? You can't just remove the block now. It has been deeply embedded within the soul. It desensitized the soul to experience spirituality and godliness in a wholesome and complete and enjoyable manner. So what has to be done? We have to go back to the original scar, to the original experience, and allow the neshama to get rid of it. If the neshama stays this way, it could spend its time in the spiritual world, but it will totally not be connected over there. It's totally not sensitive to it. You give someone who has no ear for music a ticket to go to a concert. He can go to the concert and sit through it. Does he enjoy the concert? He doesn't have an ear for the music. So they tell the anecdote about a teamster, about a wagoneer, who was a very coarse and lowly person. All his years he was a wagoneer. But once in his life, he saved a human being's life. A human being fell with his horse and wagon into a pit, and he saved him, a major mitzvah of saving a person's life. So when he came to the next world, when his soul passed on, who was he? He was who he was, but he saved a person's life. So they told him, we'll give you whatever you want. What is your wish? So he says, my wish is to give me 6 white mighty horses with a beautiful wagon. Put me on a road that has no rocks, no pebbles, no pits, no holes, that's clear. And they say that since then, he's traveling with the 6 white mighty horses on an endless smooth road. And it's a bachaya. So this soul that has the spiritual block does not allow it to experience what Olam Haba is all about, what a godly world is all about. So it must experience what's called kafakela, the hollow of a sling. It's not a punishment in the normal sense of the word. It's like all punishments of Torah. There's a misconception of the punishments of Torah to be understood as retribution, vengeance. No. The punishments of Torah, the Alter Rebbe explains many places, are to be understood as a healing process. Healing is often painful, but it's necessary. It's an integral part of the healing. What is the experience of kafakela, the hollow of the sling? The neshama is now in a spiritual realm. It has to return. It's thrown in into its previous life, into that moment of experience where it was scarred, with something that's antithetical to its essence, that's antithetical to its identity. It has to re-experience that. That's a painful experience. And then the neshama spits it out of its system. It comes in contact with it. It deals with it. The neshama spits out its pain, its deep sorrow and misery that was introduced into its identity as a result of it. And now it's taken back to its original place, and it's a whole different identity. It's a whole different reality. So the Alter Rebbe is saying here that one of the experiences for which the neshama needs kafakel is dvarim betelim beheter. Although it's dvarim betelim beheter, it's permitted innocent idle chatter, but it's idle chatter. And idle chatter is doing misjustice to the soul. Since it's doing misjustice to the soul, so therefore it has to cleanse itself by going through the experience of kafakela. And this is the difference between eating, which the Alter Rebbe discussed earier, and idle chatter. Eating is a bodily experience. It's a very physical, concrete experience. So therefore it taints mainly the body. So what's needed for that healing process is chibud hakever, purgatory of the grave. Talking idle chatter is more of a subtle, much more spiritual, abstract experience. So therefore, it has to experience kafakela, which what that does is it allows the soul to reach a higher state of consciousness, making it receptive to the godly realm of existence. You're asking, which soul are we dealing with? Are we dealing with Tzarech L'Tayir Nafshi? We're dealing with the divine soul, or we're dealing with the animalistic soul? We're dealing with both souls. Both souls become tainted because, you see, the divine soul and the animal soul in man are not two distinct units. They're not two separate units, one living in the one part of the body and the animal soul living in another part of the body. And each one has its own agenda and they live separately. Then all of us would be all of the time real schizophrenias. It doesn't work like that. The two souls work and function in one unit. The divine soul, the godly state of consciousness, is enclosed and manifested within the natural, vital, animalistic state of consciousness. Because the animalistic soul is the essence of our physical life, of our biological life. So the divine soul is enclosed within that life. In other words, if the divine soul wants to express itself physically, through talking, through doing something, it can only do it through the physical soul. The physical soul, it's a spiritual soul which animates physical life. So therefore, every experience of man, every single experience, in every experience, both souls are involved. So if it's a positive experience, if a person is eating for the sake of heaven, if a person is doing a mitzvah, so not only is his divine soul, of course, being elevated, it's being connected to, becoming connected to Hashem, even the animalistic soul, the energy that has been invested in this act has been sanctified. It has been elevated from the realm of Klipa to the realm of Kedusha, from the realm of the shell, of the husk, to the realm of truth, of inner significance. On the other hand, if the human being has engaged in an act which is hollow, which is purposeless, like idle chatter, he has fallen prey to the shell of existence, to the wrapper, rather than the true substance. So all components involved over here have been abused, have been tainted, have been defiled, have been impurified. His energy has been robbed from its true purpose, from its true end, from its true significance, which is godliness, which is to mirror and reflect the harmony, the goodness, the perfection of godliness. Instead, it has become prey to the idleness of just chatter, which is hollow and purposeless. Every part of energy that was invested in it. So both souls, which both ultimately have a destiny, an eternal destiny, even after a person's life, because the animalistic soul is not bad, it's not evil, it's not doomed to purgatory eternally. On the contrary, that also is to be educated and sanctified. Have to go through the experience of Kafakela as a healing process in order to elevate it to a higher state of consciousness, to remove the stain, so to speak, and to allow it to truly become connected and unified with the godly reality. You're asking, the Gemara says that Kafakela means the neshama being tossed or slung from one side of the world to the other. That's the imagery the Gemara uses. But what is the symbolism in this imagery, that two angels literally stand and having a football game with the neshama? Neshama is not a football, it's not a physical substance. So there's a symbolism being conveyed over here, but often it has to be decoded. So Chassidus explains that the significance of that is the neshama being thrown from one end of the world to the other means the neshama being taken away from its present spiritual, transcendental, godly environment and being brought back to view and to re-experience that moment when it lived in the physical world and it was compelled by the shell and husk reality, where now it's not compelled, and it was tainted then. Well, I think, that's why I think one of the metaphors that could be given, although again significantly different, is in the process of psychoanalysis, where the human being now is in another situation, in another environment, in other circumstances dominate his or her life. However, he's brought back in his mind, of course, not practically, but he's brought back in his mind, in his heart, in his soul, to that moment when he has experienced that. Of course that moment is gone, but the experience that that moment has wrought upon him is there in a very powerful way. It has just been buried. And the person's memory functions. And memory is a very powerful thing. It's just deeply repressed and buried by us. And the fact that we are forgetful of our past experience is a blessing. If a person would remember every time he has been pained or hurt physically or psychologically, we would not be able to survive. It's a defense mechanism that Hashem imbued in our psyches and characters, which is the defense mechanism called forgetfulness. So sometimes forgetfulness is a blessing. But sometimes the pain has brought upon the person an eternal scar. So now he has to remember. So we try to first of all, remove the defense mechanisms that don't allow the person to be honest and open. We try to allow him to become in touch with what's really going on, and to get rid of the shame and the ego that hinders these types of things, and to go deep into the recesses of his memory and of his subconscious, where that experience functions and is alive and well, and to reconnect with it, reconnect with its whole misery, and spit it out. And then he comes back. If it's an endless process, it's not an endless process. Why should it be an endless process? No, we're not talking about physically coming back. That's Gilgal. That's another process. That's another complicated issue. It's not discussed over here. Gilgal is reincarnation. No, we're not talking about that. Not the soul comes back into the body and physically re-experiences it. That's why I said it's similar to psychoanalysis. You don't go back to that experience. The neshama stays as is. It's out of the body now. It re-experiences it in a spiritual sense. Not within the body, not the whole thing happening again. Yeah.
So the unity is, so what's going on over here has to mirror something that's going on over there. So you're giving this an example, you bring it down even more. What does that mean? What's the Messiah? There is this neshama that it's all the way over there, then it comes back over here. What's the scene? All of a sudden that it's around.
You're asking if the neshama comes back here. One second. The truth is, you're asking already. The Marsha is one of the basic commentators on Gemara, and Masechta Shabbos over there, he interprets Kafakela as Gilgal. That's how the Marsha interprets it, as reincarnation, where the neshama is reincarnated in the body. And he says, therefore, if someone is not a tzaddik who has completed his mission on the face of this earth, and the neshama is totally cleansed, leaves the body, and continues to function and thrive in the spiritual realm, but not a tzaddik, has to come back. The Marsha says three times they give him in order to rectify what has been done previously. The Marsha says over there three times, but we're not discussing our reincarnation. It's a separate issue. Another time. Now we're discussing Kafakel. According to many other commentators, and as it's explained in Chassidus in many places, Kafakel is another experience. Not the neshama comes back to this world. It doesn't re-enclose in a body. It's just the neshama in its mind. Spirituality also has a personality, a character. In its mind, it's brought back to re-experience this reality. Let's continue. No. You're asking if I said that Chassidus doesn't believe in Gilgal? No, I'm saying that the interpretation of that specific Gemara, the Marsha interprets Kafakela as meaning Gilgal. But there are many other Mefarshim, including many Hasidic discourses, that explain Kafakela to be a distinct experience, divorced from the experience of Gilgal. But Gilgal has its sources in Kabbalah. What is the difference between Chibut HaKever and Kafakela? Experientially, I can't tell you experientially because I don't have first-hand experience in this issue. Maybe I've had, but I'm unaware of it. Generally, what is said about Chibut HaKever is discussed by Reb Chaim Vital at the conclusion of Sefer HaKavanas and Sefer HaGilgulim. It's physical purgatory of the grave, which includes, among other things, the decomposition, the rotting of the body within the grave, and other experiences that the body has after the person's passing are all connected to the realm of Chibut HaKever. Kafakela is a more psychological and spiritual experience that's connected to the psyche, identity, and personality of the soul. You're saying that Kafakela sounds like a healing experience, Chibut HaKever not. But nevertheless, the soul, not only is the soul holy, the body of the human being is also a precious commodity. The whole concept of Tchiyas HaMesim, of the resurrection of the dead, is going to happen to the body. So the body, the body is created, as you say, with Tzelem Elokim, and the body is a very precious commodity. A precious body is not impure, or defiled, or tameh. A body is something which is physical, and the human being, again, has to utilize the body in accordance with its quintessence. So Chibut HaKever is also a sense of healing, where how is that a healing experience? The whole concept of Einish and Taira is a healing process. This is the, according to the in the system. It's quite Lebedick over here today. There was once a Jew who was Nebuch poverty stricken, had a lot of daughters to marry off, they didn't have a penny to his name, lived in Russia. This was in the 1880s. So he came to the city of Lubavitch in Russia. The then Rebbe of Lubavitch, his name was Reb Shalom Ber Schneerson, who was the fifth Lubavitch Rebbe, the son of Reb Shmuel, the fourth Lubavitch Rebbe. It was just a short time after the passing of his father, Reb Shmuel, and the following Rebbe, Reb Shalom Ber, known as Rebbe Rashab, has not fully accepted the leadership of the Chabad dynasty. The Jew comes into the Rebbe, and he pours out his bitter heart concerning all his problems, his dilemmas, his misery, and he says, Rebbe, please help me. So the Rebbe looks at him and he says, I'm sorry, but I can't help you. The Jew, hearing this, runs out of the room, breaks out in tears, weeps, and faints. The Rebbe had an older brother whose name was Reb Zalman Aharon. He's known in the Chabad literature as the Raza, which is an acronym of Reb Zalman Aharon. Reb Zalman Aharon walks through the corridors and he sees a Jew who's fainted. So he immediately revives him, helps him get up, and asks him what happened. So the Jew tells him the whole story. So Reb Zalman Aharon runs into his younger brother. As mentioned, it was in the early years of his leadership, so he was not, so to speak, a full Rebbe yet. And he said, I don't understand you. This is how you treat a Jew who has come from so far, who experienced such misery in his life? Even if you can't help him, you just say, I'm sorry, I can't help you, have a nice day. Don't our sages say that in the worst circumstances a person should never stop asking for mercy from Hashem? So the Rebbe Rashab says, okay, call him back in. So he calls him back in. He puts on his hat and his girdle, and he gives him a blessing for everything he needed, and he went home and everything was fine. So the Rebbe once said the story and asked, what's going on over here? Memanavshach, as they say. Whichever way you look at it, it seems to be very absurd. If the Rebbe Rashab had the ability to bless him, why didn't he bless him originally? If he didn't have the ability to bless him, why did he act towards him in such a way? But then later, he blessed him and it did help. So the Rebbe explained as follows. When this Jew came into the room of the Rebbe Rashab, he was not a vessel to receive a blessing. It could rain from today till tomorrow. If you don't plow your field, nothing will grow. If you don't plow and sow, it won't produce. Why? It rained. It rained, but rain is not enough. You have to create, you have to craft a vessel, you have to be receptive to something. You can have a teacher, a pupil, a professor who is giving you and teaching you and enlightening you and educating you. If you don't listen, if you're not receptive to it, if you don't review it, if you don't toil, you have been given a flow of energy, but you didn't have any vessels with which to contain it, with which to receive it. So it just comes over you and it doesn't affect you. This Jew in his present spiritual moment, he was not a vessel to receive a new flow of godly energy. There was a certain sense of ego and vanity that was not allowing him to become receptive to that, to something deeper. So the Rebbe Rashab had to tell him what he told him. And that broke his heart. And he fainted. That experience crafted him and molded him into an identity which has become a vessel for a new blessing. That very experience. He has suspended his ego and his husk, and that very experience allowed him to become receptive to something new, to a deeper energy, to a deeper flow of vitality, of existence. So then when he came back in, he gave him the bracha, and the bracha helped. Which means sometimes the act of negation, whether it is in the psychological sense, in the spiritual sense, in the physical sense, is integral and crucial for allowing the human being to become a vessel to a deeper type of energy. And the same is true concerning Chibud HaKever. So you're asking if the punishments are not punishments. They're just a healing process. Why can Hashem do the healing other ways? Basically, what you're asking is, why doesn't you just do the healing miraculously? Let him just heal you miraculously. But then you have a question on the whole concept of life. He should have placed us into this world and miraculously caused that we should do only what we have to do and fulfill our purpose always, all the time, 100%. But then, one second, it's the same thing. He wanted that the human being should do it. He didn't want we should be robots who are fulfilling the ends that have been programmed within us through certain buttons. He wants the human being should have free choice. And human being has free choice means he could do both things. He could live life in totally two different ways. Then the human being has achieved it. He has achieved it. When the Jew lives in accordance with the Torah, what happens was he has now truly become connected. His reality and his identity, which had free choice, truly contributed and truly become connected. He's not a robot. It is his achievement. So this is just a process. So when the person does misjustice to himself, the healing process is also a process that's done through the mechanics of what he has accomplished. There's no miracle works over here. There's even a whole literature in Torah, a whole shitta, that the punishments in Torah are a natural result of the transgression. Natural result. Let's continue. This is concerning Dvarim B'Telem B'Heter, which means innocent idle chatter. Avol Deborim Asurim, but with regard to forbidden speech, K'mayla Tzonnes V'Loshen Harav V'Kayetzeben. such as scoffing, slander, and the like, shehein mishalosh klipos atmeis legamri, which being prohibited, stem from the three completely unclean klipos, dvarim betalim, which is purposeless talk, idle chatting about things which are idle, which have no significance, which have no purpose, any type of purpose, is not a transgression, essentially. It's something which is permitted. Over here, you're talking about something which is an iser, which is prohibited, something which cannot be rectified if you do it with the intention for the sake of, if you do it for the sake of heaven, if you do it with a godly intention. It's objectively an object which receives its vitality from the three unclean klipos. That's what Lashon Hara and Letzonos is. In this case, ein kafa kela levade, mayilu tayiru lahavir tamasim ha-nefesh, the hollow of a sling alone does not suffice to cleanse and remove the impurity of the soul, although the hollow of the sling is also required, because Letzonos and Lashon Hara and such type of words also possess the disadvantage of the impurity that Dvarim B'Talem possess. But this alone is not enough. It will not suffice. Rak tzricha leirid l'gehenem. The soul must descend into Gehenem, into purgatory, if the human being has not done tshuva, has not repented, has not rectified these sins, these transgressions, the neshama has to descend into purgatory. When the spiritual scar is not so deep, kafakela will suffice. But when the spiritual scar is deeper, kafakela doesn't suffice. It also has to experience Gehenem. For example, the metaphor given is a garment. If you have dust in the garment, you have to shake it off, and it will be removed. If you have a lot of dust and a lot of dirt, you have to shake it harder. Sometimes you have to bang it, and it will be removed. But if you have a stain in the garment, you can shake it from today to tomorrow. The stain will not be removed. It needs a wash. It has to be. It has to go through a certain process where you place chemicals in order to remove the stain.